was over. She wasn't going back, and she wasn't going forward, either. She would stay in this stupid little windowless room with its crap carpet forever, if necessary. She loved it. It was the most beautiful room she'd ever seen. She had teetered on the edge of the rabbit hole, windmilling her arms for balance, but in the end she had not fallen. She had not. She had stayed in the safe, sunlit world of grass and sky, and she would never leave it again. She had been so wrong ever to think about it. It had tried to take her, but she would not be taken. Plum sank down on the couch. Her knees were two bags of water. She forced herself to think about what it meant. Someone had found out that she was a Chatwin, or something had found out, and they, or it, was trying to scare her. Or maybe it was one of those things where you automatically saw your greatest fear or something. But what it felt like was Fillory itself had reached out and tugged lightly on the invisible thread tied to the fishhook that was lodged firmly in her back, and it had whispered, "Don't forget, you belong to me." But she had learned her lesson, or at any rate a lesson. She would never try to enter the wine closet in anything but a straightforward and conventional fashion. The couch was so saggy and broke back that it almost swallowed her up. She stopped thinking. She looked at her reflection in the long mirror that Darcy and Chelsea had cracked last night. But she wasn't in the mirror. There was another girl there instead of her, or at least it was shaped like a girl. It was blue and naked, and its skin gave off a soft, unearthly light. Even its teeth were blue. It smiled at her. Its eyes were the same color as its skin. It hung motionless in midair, a yard above the floor, slightly smaller than life-size. The girl's outlines were strange. Sometimes she was slightly blurry, other times crisp and clear. Plum sat up. She got to her feet, but slowly, and after that she didn't move at all, because she understood that all moving was over with. She knew who this was. It was the ghost of Breakbills. It had been the ghost all along. This wasn't a friendly ghost. It wasn't a mischievous poltergeist. This was a dead thing that hated the living. Once, as a child after a storm, Plum had seen a downed power line writhing like a lethal snake on a road, arcing over and over again on the wet asphalt, bright as a sun. This blue girl was like that. The insulation had come off the world, and Plum was facing the raw, naked current. The two girls stared at each other, the one who survived and the one who hadn't. It smiled wider, like they were having a tea party. "No," Plum said. "It's not me. You don't want me." But Plum was lying. She understood. The ghost did want her. It had always wanted her. She was a Chatwin, and Chatwins lived on borrowed time. Plum wondered if it would hurt. Bump! The sound came from the wall to her left. Something had run into it from the other side. A shower of plaster fell. A man's voice said something like, "Oof!" Plum looked. The ghost in the mirror didn't. Boom! The wall exploded inward, throwing chunks of wood and plaster and stone in all directions, and Plum ducked, and a man came crashing through it, covered with white dust. It was Professor Coldwater. He shook himself like a wet dog to get some of the dust off, though he still looked like he'd been hit with a sack of flour. White witchery sprayed out of both his hands like sparklers, so bright they made purple flares in her vision. When he saw what was in the mirror, he froze. "Oh," he said quietly. "Oh, my God, it's you." Plum didn't think he was talking to her. Did he recognize this thing? It was almost like he knew it personally, which would be pretty weird even for him. He took a deep breath and pulled himself together. "Don't move till I tell you," he said. That was meant for Plum. She didn't move, but she didn't dare to believe that he could actually save her. All she'd done was drag him into the catastrophe, too. With an arm protecting his face, Professor Coldwater reared back one of his long legs and kicked in the mirror. It took him 3 kicks. The first 2 times the glass just starred and sagged, but the 3rd time his foot went right through it. It got a little stuck when he tried to pull it out. It was a measure of how shocked she was that Plum's first thought was, "I must tell Chelsea that she won't have to pay for the mirror." That didn't dispel the ghost, but it was definitely inconvenienced. It was still watching them, suspended in mid-air, but now it had to peer around the edge of the hole. Professor Coldwater turned his back on it. The ghost threw something at them. Plum couldn't see what, and he deflected it with 1 hand without looking. Then he placed his palms together. "Get down," he said, "all the way, on the floor." She got down. The air shimmered and rippled, and her hair crackled with so much static electricity it made her scalp hurt. The entire world was shot through with light. At the bottom of it was the dull bass pressure beat of the door exploding outward out of its frame. "Now get up and run," Professor Coldwater said. "Run! Go ahead, I'm right behind you." Plum ran. She could have stayed and tried to help, but that would have been compounding her stupidity with more stupidity. She did the hard thing and trusted him. She hurdled the couch like a champion and felt a shockwave as Professor Coldwater detonated some final spell. The force of it lifted Plum off her feet for a second and made her stagger, but she found them again and kept on running. Going back was faster than going forward had been. She was bounding ahead 7-league boot style, which at first she thought was adrenaline, till she realized, nope, magic. 1 stride took her through the Hell Room, another and she was in Colonial break bills, then she was in Wharton's room, on the roof, in the dining room crawl space, the library, hard left turn at the creepy pear tree courtyard, the passage. The sound of doors slamming shut behind her was like a string of firecrackers going off. She didn't stop till she was back in the safety of the senior common room, breathing hard. He was right behind her, just as he'd said. He'd done it. He'd gotten them out. Never had anything seemed so certain than that she was going to die in that room, but now it was over. The bad thing, the horror, had broken out of wherever it had been hiding all her life, but he'd shoved it back down. For now. Without a word, Professor Coldwater set about resealing the passageway behind them. She watched him work, her breath slowly going back to normal, dazed, but not so dazed that she wasn't interested in the technical aspects. Moving in fast motion, his arms flying crazily like a time-lapse movie, he assembled an entire intricately patterned brick wall in about 5 seconds. She wondered where he'd learned how to do that. Not here. This time he left out the fancy signature angles. Say that for him. He learned from his mistakes. Then he climbed out and closed the door. They were alone. It could all have been a dream except for the plaster dust on the shoulders of Professor Coldwater's blazer.
"How did you know?" she said. "How did you know where I was? Where the ghost was?"
"Not a ghost. A niffin. Very bad news."
"What did it want?"
She used to be human. And I don't know. Did she say anything to you?"
"No. Can they talk?"
"I don't know." One of his fingers was still crackling with a bit of white fire. He shook it, and it went out. "Nobody knows much about them. I'm not even sure I did anything to her. I just distracted her and got out of there."
"But you looked surprised when you saw it. You looked like you recognized it. I mean, her."
"I know." Professor Coldwater looked sadder and less triumphant than she would have thought. "I know I did. I wish she'd said something."
I don't care if it recited the goddamn King James Bible.
Dean Fogg rounded the corner of the L at speed. He didn't look happy.
Do you know how many alarms you two set off, blundering around in the subspaces like that?
Professor Coldwater ticked off on his fingers silently. 11?
Yes, 11.
Fogg seemed perversely unhappy that Coldwater had got the right answer.
What the hell were you doing back there, Purchase?
Plum flushed. The prank, she'd completely forgotten about it. She still had Wharton's stupid pencil case in her stupid pocket. It was so utterly pointless. Maybe that's what the ghost was trying to teach her. It's all pointless. Fate is coming, whatever you do, so quit wriggling around. It's only making you look more ridiculous than you already do. We're all ghosts here. You just don't look like one yet. But she wasn't having that. If that was true, then what was the point of anything, ever? She was going to wriggle a bit longer, anyway. Who the hell cared how ridiculous she looked? Plum squared her shoulders and lifted her chin. I was looking for a secret passage to the wine closet, she said, loud and clear, so I could play a prank on Wharton.
A prank?
Fogg was unimpressed with her existential courage.
I see. Coldwater?
Dean Fogg.
You didn't perform the incursion protocols, any of them?
No, Coldwater said. I didn't. There wasn't much time. The situation was pretty urgent.
Did you at least try to terminate the damn thing, or banish it?
He bit something back.
No.
Why not?
A muscle moved in Professor Coldwater's jaw.
I couldn't do that.
Professor Coldwater saved my life,
Plum put in.
Thank you, Purchase, Fogg said, and he also put the lives of everybody else at this school at risk. I took a chance on you, Quentin, and it was a mistake. You're fired. Be out of your rooms by end of day tomorrow. Professor Liu can pick up the rest of your teaching.
Coldwater didn't flinch, didn't even blink. But Plum flinched for him, the way you do when you see somebody else take a punch.
All right, I understand.
Do you?
Fogg was so angry he was spitting.
Do you? Well, you always were a quick one. I would think you, of all people, would have caught on a little quicker, given that you witnessed firsthand the reason why these protocols were created in the first place. Purchase?
Yes, sir.
You can finish out the last 3 weeks of the semester, then you're expelled.
Fogg glared at them both in turn, then walked out of the room. Plum so wished she could be cool about it. She didn't think she was going to cry. She just had to sit down on one of the red leather couches and put her head between her knees for a minute while her vision grayed out around the edges. She really did love Breakbills. She loved it so much. She really did. She really had. She felt the sofa squish as Professor Coldwater sat down at the other end. He blew out a long sigh.
Well, I'm so sorry, Professor Coldwater. I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to put you in danger. I didn't mean to get you fired.
And now she did sob. Once, twice, three times. They were going to turn her out into the cold, scary world. She wasn't ready. It wasn't safe. What was she going to do? How was she going to live now?
I know. Please don't worry about it.
He said it quietly. I've been thrown out of better places than this. And you might as well call me Quentin.
But what are you going to do? What am I going to do?
You'll find something. It's a big world. Probably bigger than you realize.
But I'm a failure. I'm a freak. I got kicked out of Breakbills, for God's sake.
The words barely had any meaning. They would soon, she knew, but right now it made her lips feel numb just to say them, as if the words were envenomed.
She was expelled.
She thought of having to say them to her parents, and the gray came back.
Something will come up, I promise you. Plenty of people have Breakbills degrees,
But how many people can say they got kicked out? It's a pretty exclusive club.
She wasn't so far gone that she didn't snort at that.
But if you don't mind my asking, he went on, what exactly were you doing back there? I sealed that corridor off for a reason. Even I couldn't figure out where it went.
Oh, I told Fogg the truth. I really was pranking Horton.
But why?
Well, he's been kind of stingy with the wine lately. Plus, it just seemed to me like there should be more, I don't know, chicanery afoot around here. Generally, hijinks. It sounds silly now, but you know what I mean? To lighten the tone. Because basically, who knows, we could all drop dead at any moment.
That is true.
Or get expelled.
Quentin appeared to accept her reasoning at face value.
Old people, you never knew what you were going to get.
Do you still want to know where the secret passage is? To the wine closet?
Sure, Plum said, though not unshakily. She managed a bitter little laugh. Why the hell not?
But she meant it. Fuck it. They could take break bills away from her, apparently. But at least the honor of the League would live on eternally. She would always have that.
You want the next panel over, Quentin said. You don't count the half panel.
Aha.
She drew the same rune word she had before, and the door opened, and she peered inside. It was just what she thought, a cakewalk. Not even 100 yards, more like 75. After all that, the timing was pretty close to perfect. Plum had just closed the secret door to the wine closet behind her. It was concealed behind a trick wine rack. When Horton came bustling in through the front door with the rumble and glow of the cheese course subsiding behind him. Her hair was a mess, but that was just part of the effect. It was all extremely League. Horton froze. With a freshly recorked bottle in one hand and two inverted wine glasses dangling from the fingers of the other, Plum regarded him calmly. Some of the charm of Horton's face came from its asymmetry. He'd had a hair lip corrected at some point, and the surgery had gone well, so that all that was left was a tiny tough guy scar, as if he'd taken one straight in the face at some point, but kept on trucking. Also, he had an incredibly precious widow's peak. Some guys had all the luck.
"You've been short pouring the fins," she said.
"Yes," he said. "You have my pencils."
"Yes."
"It's not the pencils I mind," Wharton said, "so much as the case and the knife. They're antique silver, Smith and Sharp. You can't find those anywhere anymore."
She took the case out of her pocket. She wasn't going to give an inch, not even after everything else, especially not. To hell with the ghost, and to hell with break bills, and to the deepest, darkest hell with the Chatwins. The world had split open under her feet, and nothing would ever be the same, but she would still play her part to the hilt. To the end. They couldn't take that away.
"Why have you been short pouring the fins?"
"Because I need the extra wine."
God, was he really an alcoholic? Nothing should surprise her at this point, but still, he didn't seem like the type. Epifanio, maybe, but not Wharton. And Wharton wouldn't be an enabler like that.
"But what do you need it for?" Plum held the case just out of reach.
"I'll give you back the pencils and all that. I just want to know."
"What do you think?" Wharton said. "I leave it out for the damn ghost. I thought the wine might keep it happy. That thing scares the shit out of me."
Wharton had a lot to learn about ghosts. She sighed and sat down on a crate. All her strength was gone.
"Me too."
She handed him the case. Wharton sat down next to her and pulled over a little table. He placed the two glasses on it.
"Wine?"
"Thanks," Plum said. "I'd love some."
"If not now, when?" He poured properly this time, even a little heavy. The dark liquid looked black in the glass, and she had to restrain herself from gulping it.
Fresh tobacco. Black currants. God, it was so good.
She kept it in her mouth for a count of 10 before she swallowed. If there was any magic in this world that was not magic, it was wine. She smelled wet hay from a tumble-down field in Tuscany in the early morning, after the sky turned light, but before the sun burned off the dew. It reminded her of somewhere else, too, a memory of a place she'd never seen, let alone smelled, someplace green and unspoiled and far away, which she knew well even though she'd never been there, just as it knew her well. She felt its pull on her, as she always had. But for the moment, she let its name escape her. Chapter 9. They'd only been at the Newark Airport Marriott for a week, and already Quentin didn't know how much longer he could stand it. This was not somewhere humans were supposed to stay more than one night in a row. It was not a long or even medium-term residence. The walls were thin, the food was lousy, and the interior decoration was worse. This place was bad for your soul. He didn't see much of the others, apart from Plum. Pushkar was busy overflying the east coast at high altitude with Lionel and the bird, scouring it for any signs of the suitcase and or the couple. Stoppard was building something large and complicated out of tiny metal parts in his bedroom, from which he emerged only once or twice a day, at odd hours, wearing an oil-stained apron. The bird had sent Betsy off with a credit card to buy supplies. Meanwhile, Quentin and Plum had been tasked with figuring out how to break the famous incorporate bond. It was a bear of a problem, nasty and complicated, a real tarball. Quentin had heard about incorporate bonds, though he'd still never seen one in real life. The theory went as follows. Picture a two-dimensional world, an infinite plane full of infinitely flat two-dimensional objects. You, a three-dimensional being, could theoretically lean down from above it and fasten one of those objects in place, anchoring it permanently to its plane from above. If you did it carefully, you might not even damage it too much. In the case of an incorporate bond, the same operation was performed in three-dimensional space, using a four-dimensional anchor to fix the object immovably with respect to the fabric of three-dimensional space-time. It was about as difficult as it sounded, and messy and expensive to boot. Four-dimensional paperweights didn't grow on trees, or at least not in this plane of existence they didn't. Incorporate bonds were the last word in magical security, and the couple must have gone through a good deal of trouble to cast the spell, but in doing so they'd rendered the case unstealable, except that the bird thought it wasn't. In Quentin's experience, magical creatures like the bird didn't tend to know a lot about magic from a technical point of view. They didn't work magic themselves, they just were magic, so the theory of it didn't really matter. Also, a lot of them weren't terribly bright. But the bird had some ideas about it, or someone had supplied it with ideas, and on the face of it they weren't demonstrably nonsense. But carrying them out posed a raft of thorny practical issues, and the bird had generously left the working out of said problems to Quentin and Plum. At first it was fun. It was a dense, rich, genuinely hard problem, and they attacked it with a will. The issue of the suitcase's Chatwin connection receded to the back of Quentin's mind as they scribbled flow charts on hotel stationery, then on reams of printer paper filched from the business center, then finally on a fat roll of butcher's paper from an art supply shop. The spell kept ramifying into more and more secondary and tertiary and quaternary spells, to the point where they had to color-code them, and the color-coding eventually ran to a full 120-count pack of Crayolas. Quentin and Plum argued more vehemently than was strictly necessary over which colors should go with which spells. That should probably have been a warning sign. After a week, they'd drilled down far enough that they were staring at some real bedrock problems, questions that looked like they ought to have answers, but which kicked back everything they threw at them. He might have given up if it hadn't been for Alice. For years, 7 of them, He'd thought of Alice as someone who belonged to the past. She wasn't dead, but she was gone. He was resigned to living his life without her. But when he saw her that night in the mirror at Brakebill's, all that ended, and she came surging roughly back into his present. He hadn't seen her since Ember's tomb, and their reunion was so chaotic and unexpected that in the moment he didn't know what to think or feel or do. Fogg was right. He hadn't followed protocol, because the protocol was designed to banish or kill anything that made it inside the Brakebill's cordon, and he wasn't going to do that. And he hadn't wanted to say why. Just like that, Alice was there, right there, close enough to talk to, close enough to kill him. Or to kill Plum, whom until that night he knew only as a face in the crowd. But she hadn't. There was a part of him that wished he hadn't seen Alice at all, that he hadn't been in the senior common room that night, that it hadn't been his turn to eat with the first years. It wasn't enough that he'd lost her once and spent 7 years getting over it. Now Alice had to hunt him down, cross worlds to find him, and get him thrown out of the only home he had. When he kicked in that mirror, part of him had meant it. He wanted to send her back, push her back down. He knew Brakebill's was over for him even before Fogg fired him. He knew it as soon as he saw her. Because he'd felt her presence, he was sure he had. She wasn't gone. Her body had burned, but the essence of Alice was in there somewhere. The Alice, he knew, trapped inside that toxic blue flame, like a fly in amber. He'd recognized her. The old Alice, the one he used to love, twisted and distorted, but real. And he couldn't leave her there. If there was some way to get her out, he would find it. That was his job now. Teaching would have to wait. He was ready. The whole business of getting kicked out of Fillory had been good for him. It made him tougher, more grounded in reality, to the point where he could deal with getting kicked out of Brakebill's. He was basically homeless, and getting increasingly less respectable, but he knew who he was and what he had to do. He just needed a plan. He needed to get himself together. He needed resources. He needed somewhere to live. He needed to find out everything he could about Niffins. For that, he needed money, and to get money, they would have to break this damn bond. They weren't going to do that without help. Unfortunately, the only magician Quentin could think of who was smart enough to help them was very far away, on another continent, in fact. It was a place that he and Alice had known well. When Quentin first suggested a field trip to Antarctica, Plum wasn't enthusiastic. It was cold there and a pain to get to, and also Professor Mayakovsky was kind of a dick. But Plum was a creature of enthusiasm, and it didn't take her long to come around to the idea. It would be an adventure. She could be a goose again. She loved being a goose. Except, she said, even more excited, why be a goose? We've been geese. We could go as something else. Anything else. I was thinking of going as a human being, Quentin said. Like on an airplane. Plum was already at her laptop and Googling. Okay, check this out. What's the fastest migratory bird on Earth? An airplane. Whatever. You're like the bullshittiest magician ever. Look at this. It's called the Great Snipe. Are you sure that's a real bird? It sounds like something from Lewis Carroll. Some have been recorded to fly nonstop for 48 hours over 6,760 kilometers, I'm quoting here, from Wikipedia. But still, he looked over her shoulder. The Great Snipe was a plump little wading bird, roughly egg-shaped, with a big, long bill and zigzaggy brown stripes, like a not particularly exotic seashell. It didn't look like a speed demon. Female Great Snipe are, on average, significantly larger than the male, Plum said. We'd need something to base the spell on, like some Great Snipe DNA. At least the first time we did it. I don't think we can do the transformation based on an image from a Wikipedia entry. Are you sure? They have it in high res. Even so. Plus, I'm kind of concerned about the cold. That bird doesn't look like it was evolved for Antarctica. Except it'll still be summer, Plum said. backward seasons. Even so, stop saying that, Plum frowned, then brightened up again. Okay, forget about birds. I don't know why I was even thinking birds. We could be fish. Or whales. Blue whales. We'd still have to go the last bit after we got to Antarctica. We'd just swim under the ice. That's the North Pole. Antarctica is a continent. Under the snow, it's all rock. She huffed her annoyance. Whatever, Nanook. But of course, she was right. It would be cool to be a blue whale. The idea grew on him. There was no particular reason to do it, other than it would be more interesting, but that seemed like enough. What else was magic for? It was safe, they were legally protected, and barring scattered orca attacks, blue whales had no natural predators. The only downside was that even though they were fast swimmers by cetacean standards, they turned out to be painfully slow compared with most birds, let alone the great snipe. 20 miles per hour was about a blue whale's top speed, at least over long distances. At that rate, it would take them a couple of months to get to Antarctica. I doubt we could delay the job that long, Quentin said. Yeah, Plum said sadly. It would have been nice, though. Oh, well, another dream dies. But in the end, they found a way to save it. They flew commercial most of the way, as far as Ushuaia, a small but unexpectedly charming port in Tierra del Fuego that claimed the distinction of being the southernmost city in the world. It was squeezed into a narrow strip of land between the Beagle Channel and the snow-covered peaks of the Martel Range behind it, as if it were backed up against them and trying not to fall into the freezing water. From there they could cross the Drake Passage to the coast of Antarctica in the form of blue whales. From the airport they took a taxi to the waterfront. They'd brought no luggage. From the safety of a concrete wharf, the Beagle Channel did indeed look forbiddingly cold, a flat gray stripe of sea lapped at by glaciers on either side. But they couldn't do anything from dry land. For the actual transformation, they'd have to be in deep water. Chartering a boat would have been the sensible thing to do if they were tourists or sport fishermen or smugglers. But Quentin and Plum were magicians, so they waited until midnight, then cast spells on their shoes and hiked out onto the channel on foot. It was tricky at first, till they made it out through the mercifully light surf and got used to the rhythm of the swells. It was only their shoes that were buoyant, so if they fell over, they'd get wet like anybody else. Once they were a couple hundred yards from shore, out beyond the glow of the lights along the beach, it got quiet and very dark and very cold. "I feel vaguely blasphemous doing this," Plum said. "Like only Jesus is allowed to do this." "I really don't think he'd mind." "How do you know what Jesus would mind?" She was silent for a minute, concentrating on the walking. It was not wholly unlike trying to walk on a black, cold, unusually violent, bouncy castle. "Did you like Breakbills South?" "I don't think anybody likes it, but it was good for me. I learned a lot." "Yeah, I liked it when we were animals." "That was good. Did they turn you into foxes?" She shook her head. "Bears and seals. For some reason, they don't do foxes anymore." When they'd gotten on the plane that morning, Breakbills South had seemed very far away. But now they were here, just a short splash across the Drake Passage from Antarctica, and suddenly it was very close, and his memories of it felt very fresh. They'd been so innocent then, he and Alice, even after what happened when they were foxes. Their feelings had been so big and raw and urgent, and they'd had absolutely no idea what to do with them. He wished he had it to do over again. He would try to be a nicer, stronger person. Except that wasn't quite it. What he really wished was that he had Alice back now, in the present. "Did you do that thing at the end where you raced to the pole?" Plum said. "I bet you did."
"Yep. You win."
Plum just seemed excited about going back.
"I bet you got there first."
"That one you lose."
"Ha!"
Her laughter got lost among the waves. I can't believe the great Professor Coldwater got beat to the pole. Who beat you?
A better magician than me.
Did you win your year?
I sure did, she said, by a mile.
The moon came up, unnaturally bright, a wafer of white phosphorus, but the black water seemed to swallow light rather than reflect it. Even a ripple was enough to trip over, so they wound up taking big, exaggerated steps. Farther out from the beach, the water smoothed out, but the swells got bigger. The few lighted windows in Ushuaia, which shut down after 10 o'clock, looked inexpressibly cozy. Fortunately, they were wearing warm clothes, parkas and long underwear, which, if all went according to plan, they would never see again. They hiked out about a half mile, well out into the bay. According to the nautical charts Quentin had consulted, that was far enough. They stopped and bobbed up and down on the water in place, comically, not quite in sync. They'd prepared as much of the spell as they could ahead of time. Quentin took a deep breath and rolled his shoulders. It was rare for magicians to kill themselves with their own magic, but stories that ended that way usually began something like this. All right? Plum chewed her lip and nodded. All right. Quentin peeled open a Tupperware container full of a revolting paste he'd ginned up back in New York, based on whalebone dust scraped from some scrimshaw he'd bought at an antique store. They each dipped in 2 fingers and anointed their foreheads. Maybe we should stand farther apart, Plum said. If this works, we're going to get really big.
Right.
They took a few steps back, like they were preparing to fight a duel, then faced the same direction. Quentin braced himself. Based on his memory of the goose transformation back at Breakbill's, he was pretty sure that this was going to be really unpleasant. He took a deep breath, held up his hands, and made a gentle downbeat, like he was cueing the start of a Mahler symphony. It began. Surprisingly, it wasn't that bad. Shrinking, having the mass squeezed out of him like toothpaste out of a tube, must have been the rough part of becoming a goose, because now the opposite was happening. Quentin was expanding, and it didn't feel that bad at all. He was inflating like a balloon, especially his head, which was getting absolutely huge. His parka strained and stretched and then burst apart in a cloud of down. His neck and shoulders merged into his body as the Quentin balloon grew and grew, and his eyes zoomed off in opposite directions on either side of his gigantic head. His arms and hands grew more slowly, becoming proportionally smaller, then flattened and dearticulated into flippers. It was like wearing mittens, and slid smoothly down toward his waist. His legs fused together, and something very curious was going on with his feet, but he took note of this fact only in passing. It didn't especially alarm him. The most hilarious part was his mouth. The corners raced back toward his ears so that his head was practically split in half by a 15-foot recurved smile. His lower teeth melted away completely. His upper teeth lengthened and multiplied crazily into a hairy overbite, more like a mustache than teeth. The only real moment of panic came when he toppled forward into the water and went under. His human instincts told him he was about to freeze or drown or both, but he did neither. The water was neither warm nor cold. It was nothing. It was like air. He did utter some truly epic, booming whale sneezes before his blowhole-based respiratory system got going, but even that was kind of enjoyable. And then everything was still. He was hanging in the void, neutrally buoyant, 20 feet below the surface. The Quentin blimp had been launched. He was a blue whale. He was roughly as long as a basketball court. He was in a really good mood. For a few minutes he and Plum floated next to each other, eyeball to eyeball. Then at the same time, somehow they coordinated this, they surfaced, arched their backs, sucked in gallons of air through the tops of their heads, and dove. Quentin didn't know when he'd ever felt so calm. Together with Plum, he kicked with his flat, powerful tail and began undulating through the water. It took hardly any effort. It would have taken an effort to stay still. He sucked in a huge mouthful of water. His mouth and throat distended hilariously to take in more and more and more, and then squirted it out again through his weird front teeth, his baleen, that was the word, like he was spitting tobacco. It left behind a tasty residue of wriggling krill. He'd imagined that he'd get some kind of deluxe ocean vision as part of his package of new whale senses, but in fact he didn't see much better than he had as a human. With his eyes on different sides of his head, his binocular depth perception was shot, and having no neck, all he could do to change the view was roll his eyes around or steer his whole humongous body. Also, unnervingly, he didn't seem to have any eyelids anymore. He couldn't blink. The urge decreased over time, but it never completely went away. Once they cleared Tierra del Fuego, Quentin's sensorium expanded hugely. His world became enormous. His sight may have been crap, but his hearing was something else entirely. To a blue whale, the whole ocean was a vast resonating chamber, a great watery tympanum stretched across the earth with fleeting, fugitive vibrations constantly zipping back and forth across and through it. Based on these, Quentin could feel the shape and proportions of the world around him all the time, as if he were running invisible auditory fingertips across it. If he'd had hands, he could have drawn you the coastlines of southern Chile and Antarctica and a relief map of the ocean floor in between. And if the great blue chamber ever fell silent, he made some noise of his own. He could sing. His throat was like a didgeridoo or a foghorn, blasting out deep, resonant pulses and moans. The ocean was full of voices, like a switchboard or an echo chamber, an internet even, alive with encoded information passing through it in the form of calls and responses. The whales were always checking in with each other, and Quentin checked in too, in a language he knew without having to learn it. They weren't just being social. Here was a great secret. Whales were spellcasters. Jesus, the entire ocean was crisscrossed with a whole lattice of submarine magic. Most of the spells took multiple whales to cast, and were designed to bend and herd large clouds of krill and occasionally to reinforce the integrity of large ice shelves. He wondered if he'd remember all this when he was human again. He wondered, but he didn't really care. And there was something else, something down there in the black, abyssal trenches of the ocean, something that wanted to rise. The whales were keeping it down. What was it? An army of giant squid? Cthulhu? Some last surviving Carcharodon megalodon? Quentin never found out. He hoped he never would. Much more than when he was a goose or a fox or a polar bear, Quentin felt like himself as a whale. He had a big, fat brain that was capable of running most of his personality software at the same speed he was used to. But he wasn't the same Quentin, not exactly. Whale Quentin was a calm, wise, contented Quentin. He was colossal, planetary, moving through the blue gloom, unthreatened by anything, and requiring nothing more than air through his blowhole and krill through his mouth. Drake Passage was about 500 miles across, and it would take them 2 or 3 days to swim it. But time was an idea that he was having an increasingly hard time being interested in. Time was defined by change, and very little changed for a blue whale. He noticed everything, but was concerned with nothing. Drake Passage had the worst weather in the world, literally, but all that meant was that when he surfaced for a breath, once every 15 minutes or so, The waves broke a little harder against his wide, slick back. He and Plum were great blue gods flying wingtip to wingtip, and everything around them paid homage to them. Fish, jellyfish, shrimp, sharks. Once he spotted a great white, swaggering along by itself through the depths with its permanent shit-eating grin. It had so many teeth it looked like it had braces. Nature's perfect killing machine. Go on with your bad self. No, really, it's cute. And then the ocean floor began sloping up to meet them. He'd almost forgotten what they were doing here, fumbled it away and allowed his mind to disappear forever into the endless blue whaleness of it all. But no, they were here for a reason. This was always going to be the worst part. They were going to have to deliberately beach themselves, hopefully on nice soft sand, but more likely on some rocky shale, or worse. They just had to hope their skins were thick enough and the terrain gentle enough that their delicately flanged stomachs didn't get shredded in the process. They moaned a bit at each other, as one does. Then they aimed themselves at the Antarctic coastline. As they got closer, emergency calls came in from some distant pod, warning them off, urging them to turn back for deeper water. Look out! Don't do it! It was surprisingly hard to ignore them. He felt like he was the pilot of a falling 747, and the air traffic controllers were begging him to, for God's sake, pull up, pull up! But they stayed the course, churning with their tails, pouring on speed, their massive bodies bullying through the water. If they'd had teeth, they would have gritted them. Then Quentin was lying face down on black stones under a white sky, naked, with the weak surf of the Southern Ocean washing fiery cold over his bare legs, which were already going numb. It felt like how being born must feel, being spat out of the warm, enveloping, sustaining sea and up into the bright, searing cold world. In short, it sucked. Quentin did the one thing he knew would feel good. He shut his eyes for the first time in 3 days and kept them shut for a good minute. He'd missed his eyelids. Plum was lying next to him. A minute ago he wouldn't have had to turn his head to look at her, but now he swiveled his small, pale nub of a human head in her direction. She looked back at him, pale and shivering.
"Final leg," he said thickly.
"Huh. Lips and teeth. What a concept." He pushed at them clumsily with his tongue.
"Final leg," she said.
Quentin levered himself up off the shale and immediately fell over.
"Gravity, my old enemy. What a stupid way to locomote. Standing up felt like trying to balance a telephone pole on one end."
They were on a narrow, curving beach, black pebbles and gray sand. It was just about the least tropical beach in the world. They were both naked, and there might have been a time when, as a human male, he was at least notionally interested in the sight of Plum without her clothes on. But he was still mentally more than half cetacean, and the relative nakedness or clothedness of a human of either sex really could not have been more beside the point to him. He could barely remember what they were doing here. Fortunately, they'd talked through what would happen next, drilled it into their brains, which they knew would not be functioning at full capacity. They both began searching through the rocks and tide marks, heads down. This had to be done quickly before hypothermia set in. Quentin reeled like a drunk, cutting his strange, unbearably soft, yellow-pink feet on the unsympathetic rocks until... there! A feather. White, flecked with gray. He plucked it out of a mass of sticky, smelly sea trash. No time to be picky. Basically, anything but a penguin would do. It was coming back to him, the purpose of all this. He waited, bouncing on his toes, hands clumped under his armpits to keep his fingers warm, getting increasingly self-conscious about being naked, until Plum found hers. Then he clamped the feather between his chattering teeth and they did the spells at the same time. This time the change was bad, and he threw up when it was done, though, granted, throwing up isn't as big a deal to a bird as it is to a human. He made a neat, hygienic job of it, business as usual. After its brief reunion with humanity, his brain went animal again, this time having to endure the insult of being squeezed into the tablespoon volume of a seabird's skull. He got oriented in time to watch Plum dwindle into the shape of a seabird 20 yards away, her pale body feathering over and collapsing in on itself into... He didn't even know what kind of bird she was, or for that matter, what he was. He was whatever kind of bird that feather had belonged to. A moment of contact with Plum's turmeric yellow, perfectly circular eye. Then they both took flight. Onward and upward. Chapter 10 Quentin had never heard of anybody going to break bills south in the gap between fall and spring semesters, which this was, and he wasn't even 100% positive they could get in. They might find the building shut down, Mayakovsky gone or in hiding, the whole place sealed off. If that happened, they'd have to reassess pretty fast and make a break for one of the non-magical research stations on the coast, where their arrival would be hard to explain at best. They spiraled in from above, balancing on their aching wings, steeling themselves for the moment when their webbed seabird feet would skip off the surface of some hard, invisible dome. But the moment never came. Apparently, Mayakovsky considered 500 miles of Antarctic no-man's land enough of a defense against home invasion. They alighted on the flat roof of one of the towers and became human again. Quentin figured it was better to let Mayakovsky find them rather than the other way around. He didn't want to startle the old magician into some lethal display of defensive magic, so they made as much noise as possible coming down the stairs. First stop was the laundry, where they secured some Brakebill's South robes. The nakedness issue was starting to feel urgent again. The place felt off-limits, out of bounds. It was like they were hunting a minotaur in its maze. Quentin trailed one hand idly along a wall, and the smooth stone was cool and sticky with condensed moisture. Something about the heating spells. It gave off a damp basement smell that brought back memories of the last time he'd been here, when they were all studying 18 hours a day under Mayakovsky's rule of silence. There was something he didn't have to worry about at Brakebill's South. Nostalgia. He was too hungry to feel anything anyway. They wound up in the kitchen where they stuffed themselves on anything they could find that might possibly get the taste of bird beak out of their mouths. Quentin was keenly aware that Mayakovsky had no real reason to help them, even assuming he could. He'd always known he wouldn't have much to offer by way of compensation, aside from an intellectually interesting problem and some shameless flattery, and, he supposed, the strictly platonic presence of a smart and pretty young woman. But somehow it had all been more convincing when they were first setting out. They never heard Mayakovsky coming. He just appeared in the doorway, silent as a ghost, looking grim and hungover and unbathed. His stubble was slightly frostier, his gut more prominent, his nails yellower, but otherwise he was perfectly preserved. It was like Antarctica had freeze-dried him. He didn't kill them.
"Saw you coming," he growled, "miles away."
He had on a dressing gown, unbelted, a white button-down shirt badly in need of bleach, and a pair of very short, very unprofessorial, shorts. "Professor Mayakovsky," Quentin stood up brightly, "I apologize for intruding on your privacy like this, but we're working on an interesting problem, and we could use your help with it." Mayakovsky sawed the end off a stale loaf of bread with an unwashed knife, spread about an inch of soft, unrefrigerated butter on it, and began to eat standing up. It was pretty clear he wasn't going to throw the ball back, so Quentin kept going. He explained about incorporate bonds and what they were trying to do, and why he, Mayakovsky, alone among all practitioners of the arts invisible, could give them the assistance they so desperately needed. Mayakovsky chewed steadily and noisily, gazing into the distance with watery, rapidly blinking eyes. When Quentin was done, Mayakovsky swallowed, sighed, his round shoulders rising and then falling under his robe, and left the room. He came back with a piece of paper and a blunt pencil. He swept some crumbs onto the floor and put them down in front of Quentin.
"Write it down," he said.
He pointed at Plum.
"You, make coffee."
Plum made a monster face at him behind his back. Quentin turned up his palms. "What are you going to do?" She made a monster face at him, too.
"Fine," he said. "You draw. I'll make the coffee."
While Plum produced a crude approximation of their original flowchart, Quentin made coffee in a battered Soviet-era espresso maker. Mayakovsky came back for both the drawing and the coffee. He didn't bother to pour, he just took the whole machine and left again. It was just as well. Quentin was getting tired. He hadn't slept for 4 days. There had been no breaks during the flight from the coast, and whales didn't really sleep at all. He found his way to the dormitory wing by memory and lay down on a cot in one of the empty cells and fell asleep in the milky white Antarctic light. He had no idea how long he'd slept, but when he came back down to the dining hall, matters had progressed. Mayakovsky was back, now wearing glasses with heavy black frames, sitting at a table, talking heatedly at Plum and waving his arms. The flowchart was on the table in front of them. It looked like it had been repeatedly folded into 2-inch squares and then unfolded again. Most of the white space was now full of annotations and calculations in Mayakovsky's tiny, blocky handwriting, a jumble of numbers and letters, Roman and Cyrillic, and more obscure symbols. Quentin pulled up a chair. Mayakovsky's body odor was sharp as cheese.
"It is crazy what you are doing."
Mayakovsky shook his head with Slavic melancholy, as if their sheer incompetence saddened him.
"A valid exploit, yes. All right. Crude. This here, totally unnecessary. Totally."
He tapped the paper heavily.
"And this, you transpose. It is working against your secondary effects here and here. Spell is fighting itself. You understand? But the rest is not so terrible."
It was better than Quentin expected. Listening to him crisply parse their tangled, fudged work, he knew they'd been right to come to him, however much it had cost them and might still cost them.
"This, though, no."
It was a round, resonant, definitive Russian no. He indicated one of the later stages of the spell with the back of his hand, like he didn't even want to touch it. It was that far beneath his contempt.
"It is impossible. Waste of time. You need more power. Much more. It is a simple matter of scale. You are, I don't know, you are trying to dig through a mountain using a toothpick."
Professor Mayakovsky shook his head again. His mood was darkening visibly, heading for black.
"You are needing more power, much more. See? Here. And here."
He indicated 2 points on their flow chart. Like a lot of Russians, Mayakovsky had mastered many arcane points of higher mathematics, but not the English letter H.
"Between here and here."
"I said that," Plum said. "Remember? That's basically exactly what I said." "I remember." Quentin stared at the chart. His confidence was flagging. It all seemed very inadequate now. "How much more power?"
"Much. Orders of magnitude."
Magnitude.
"You want to break the bond with these?"
He grabbed Quentin's fingers in one paw-like hand and shook them in front of Quentin's face.
These little things? Waste of time would take 100 years, or 100 quintins.
Or 100 plums, Plum said.
50 plums,
Mayakovsky said gallantly with a quick yellow grin.